All right, so here we are once again, and we're going to tell the story of resurrection. And so I thought maybe we could start with this question. So turn to a neighbor and just ask this question. Why do we tell stories in general? Why do you think we tell stories? All right, I'll give you a couple minutes. Stories, why do we tell stories? Because they sound awesome. Cool, yeah. To care, keep history going, to connect, meaning, to cope. I heard someone over here. One more time. Values, yeah, things that are important to us. Escapism, good. Spoken like a true seven, I like it. So I was thinking through the story of resurrection. And I thought about my dog. So we met her 12 years ago. We stumbled across a picnic table filled with puppies. I do not recommend that you... I have a picture, I think. So if you ever see a table full of puppies, don't stop. Unless you would like to accidentally come home with a puppy, which is what happened. Here's some pictures of her when she was a baby. She was tiny, tiny, tiny. Yeah. And she hasn't grown that much. She's still pretty small. Fierce. So her name's Mochi. She has 9 lives at least, we think. And so I'll tell you a couple of these stories where she just keeps on ticking. So do you remember a couple, like maybe a month ago, there was a cold front and it was like 20 degrees? Remember that? And I did something that morning that I've never done in Texas before. Before I drove my son to school, I went and warmed the car. We used to do that in Canada. So I get up, leave the house, open the front gate, and I almost kicked something outside of the gate, and it was Mochi. And she had escaped for snacks. It's always for snacks. And then somehow gotten so cold, disoriented, and she was shivering. She could barely open her eyes. And I was like, oh, no, poor girl. So I picked her up. I brought her in the house. We put towels on her. Noah warmed some blankets. We put towels. And then I took him to school. I was super nervous, rushed back thinking I'd take her to the vet. I open the door, and she shows. She's like, what's up? Like, totally fine. Just like, nothing had happened. Like, cool. This fall, Karen was out of town, Joshua was in Melbourne, and it was just Noah and myself. And it was late one night, and she started wheezing a little bit. She was having some trouble breathing. And it was pretty late, so I called the vet, and the vet was like, yeah, it's pretty late. I was like, should we come in? Should we go to 24-hour care? And she said, if her gums look blue, then you should probably take her to 24-hour care. If not, she'll probably be fine until the morning. So I look at her gums. They weren't blue. And we're like, all right, we'll wait. So in the middle of the night, I wake up. I'm kind of worried, and I go look for Mochi. She's lying on the couch, and she's really having a lot of trouble breathing. And so it's 3 in the morning. Noah's in bed. I don't know what to do. Don't know if I should go to the vet. So I lay next to her, and I'm just petting her, and she's like really, you know, just having a lot of trouble. I look up her gums, and they're kind of turning blue, and I was like, oh, no. So I'm laying next to her, and we have this really beautiful moment where I'm like, Mochi, we're so thankful for you. You've been a part of our family for 12 years, even though Joshua and Karen, they're not here. And she looked like she was really hurting. I was like, if it's time to go, if it's your time, it's okay. You can go. And I was kind of teary, like crying, kind of cried myself to sleep on the couch. The next thing I know, I wake up, it's the morning, and Mochi's not there. I leave the living room. She comes running around the corner. She's like, what's up? And I was like, you've got... It's like a vampire. Just like... So in my tradition growing up, I grew up fundamentalist. Sometimes Easter felt like telling those kind of stories. Easter felt like an exceptional story that happened to someone else. And our job was... It was kind of like a visit to the insurance company once a year. Kind of like, if I can just say the right combination of words, then I'll have afterlife insurance. So you'd be like, Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. That's like a secret combo. It's like right, left, right, left, up, down, A, B, A, B. It's like, we're good, right? We're good, right? And what happens is, if you just stop there, perhaps we miss the meaning of resurrection. And maybe we tell these stories over and over again because the story is endlessly meaningful. And as we tell these stories, we mine it for meaning. And perhaps over time, we embody the meaning of resurrection. So the question I want to ask this morning is, what does resurrection mean for you? If I were to ask you, what would you say? This is what it means for Thomas Merton. He says, Easter's our hour of our own deliverance. From what? We're delivered from our harsh judgments of ourselves and others. Here is all the greatness, all the unimaginable splendor of the Easter mystery. Here is the grace of Easter, which we fail to lay hands on because we are afraid to understand its full meaning. To understand Easter and live it, we must renounce our dread of newness and of freedom. So that's what it means for Thomas Merton. And the question I want to ask is, what does it mean for you this morning? This is what it means for Brendan Manning. He says this: we remember resurrection with one purpose in mind, to make a brand new creation. Not to make people with better morals, but to create a community of prophets and lovers and men and women who would surrender to the mystery, who would enter into the center of it all, the very heart and mystery of Christ, into the center of the flame that consumes and sets everything aglow with peace, joy, boldness, extravagant, furious love. And so for us this morning, maybe the question isn't, what do I think of resurrection? But what is it that it means to you in this season? And so our gospel text will be John 20. As is our custom, we'll have it on the screen. Read it aloud to a neighbor, and then we'll walk through it. All right? John 20. All right. So to get us up to speed, so this crew, this community that's been together for several years, they've just gone through a deeply traumatic event. So in the last 3 days, they've experienced betrayal, injustice, loss, the loss of a dream. And this is why we tell these stories, because these are our stories of betrayal, injustice, loss, and broken dreams. So it says in John 20, verse 1, it says, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. So our story starts, everyone's still sleeping, and Mary awakes while it's still dark. And I wonder if we tell these stories because perhaps awakening, our healing, begins while it's still dark. I think sometimes we're promised that our healing and awakening are these instantaneous moments. And I think sometimes it can happen. Like, this is what we were promised. This is what it feels like. Did any of you watch the Batman cartoon growing up? Like the old one, right? I think I have a picture. Like, this is what healing and awakening was promised to me. Like, bam, pow, healed, awakened, right? And if you've lived life just a little bit, awakening doesn't happen like that. And perhaps this story is trying to remind us that awakening is more like the gentle slowness of the rising sun. So I found this poem by Malcolm Geet that captures, I think, the essence of the slowness of Mary's awakening. And so I'll read it and just receive it and meditate on it. This is what he says. He blesses every love which weeps and grieves. And now he blesses hers who stood and wept and would not be consoled or leave her love's last touching place, but watched as low light crept up from the east, a sound behind her stirs, a scatter of bright bird songs through the air. She turns, but cannot focus through her tears or recognize the gardener standing there. She hardly hears his gentle question, why are you weeping? Or sees the play of light that brightens as she chokes out her reply. They took my love away, my day is night. And she hears her name, and she hears love say the word that turns her night and ours today. And I just want to name that on Easter Sunday, I think a lot of us enter this room with parts of our lives that are still asleep or in the dark. And it's Easter, so we're all dressed up and everyone's got a smile. But there's this burden, there's this part of us in the shadow. Maybe we're still living in a betrayal or an injustice or a loss or a broken dream. And perhaps the reminder this morning is when it still feels dark, perhaps awakening is already happening. So some of you know the comedian Dax Shepard. Do you guys know him? He's probably best known for his role in the prophetic film Idiocracy. So here's a clip. He shares his story of his awakening, which is his journey to sobriety. And he tells a story which he thought was his rock bottom, and it turns out there were more. So check out the clip.
I had gotten pills for what I would have assumed would have been the next week and a half. So I had gotten maybe 100 Vicodin, 80 Percocet, 40 Xanax, like 50, 60 diet pills. I go out on Friday night. I run into a guy. I'm getting coked. Do you want some? Yeah, I'll get an 8-ball. I get an 8-ball. Then I'm at the bar and I'm like, I don't want to be at this bar. I want to be back at my apartment doing this. So I stop on the way home and I get 2 fifths of Jack and a case of beer. Okay, that's Friday night. I come to in my bed and it's dark out. And I'm like, oh man, it must be like Saturday night. Like I'm a little foggy on. I remember buying all that stuff and going back to my apartment, and that's where the memory stops. And I like get up and my ribs hurt really bad. And then I go out in the kitchen and I see that it's all gone. Everything's gone. There's 2 empty fifths. There's beer cans everywhere. There's plastic from where the Coke was. The pill box is empty. I come to realize that it's Monday. And I'm like, I've never had an experience like that where I missed two, three days. I have nothing. And again, this is, you would call this a rock bottom in that I fully acknowledge you should not wake up from that. There's 90% of people are not waking up from that amount of stuff. And I called my mom crying, just scared, like very, I scared myself so bad. And, you would assume that would be it.
Yeah.
And no, there was a good year of drug use and alcohol use beyond that moment.
And so I propose that perhaps his awakening did begin then, but it took a year for the sun to begin to rise. And it took him quitting, not quitting, but the awakening was already happening. I have a second clip where his friend is house sitting for him, and he stumbles onto his big book from AA. And he opens it. So check out the clip.
It's really funny because my first thought when he's telling the story that he found that book is I'm embarrassed by that. Like, I'm embarrassed how many times I quit and couldn't do it.
Quit drinking and drugs,
yeah. So he's explaining that he was sitting on the couch early in the mornings looking at these dates. And what he sees, as opposed to me, is he sees someone who just won't quit. And he starts crying while he's saying that because I think he's been there too. And then I get really emotional. And I, for maybe the first time, am proud of myself that I didn't quit.
Yeah.
Because it's demoralizing. Like to truly be powerless over something is fucking demoralizing. It's so rough. And yeah, that was one of those things where it's kind of a source of shame for me. And then I see his reaction to that and that's a source of optimism for him. It like infected me where I was like, oh, yeah, good on you. You did. You kept at it. You didn't die from this. And a lot of us do.
And so perhaps this morning we're reminded that awakening is perhaps more like the gentle slowness of the rising sun. And sometimes we read these verses in scripture that seem paradoxical. And I wonder if we hold both of them like Christ's arms on a cross. As we hold the both that seem like their intention, and maybe the paradox is this process that heals us. Because on one hand, we have verses like Paul. He says, I don't understand my own actions, for I do what I want, or do not do what I want, and I do the very thing I hate. And we've all been there. We can relate to that. And then on the other hand, you have the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never end. Every morning there's new mercies. Every morning you wake up, there's more mercies. Great is your faithfulness. And perhaps healing and awakening and slowness is the paradox of those two things, and trusting that while it still feels dark, maybe God is healing us. Brennan Manning says it like this: the men and women who are truly filled with light are those who have gazed deeply into the darkness of their own imperfect existence. And so maybe this week a spiritual practice could be this. So maybe observe a sunrise. I was going to leave it at that, but I know everyone's not a morning person. So a sunset's probably fine. I think the speed of it is the point. Okay? So don't bring your phone. Turn off your phone. So if you're doing a sunrise, start when it's dark. And then just sit as long as it takes for the sun to come all the way up. And just be present with how slow it is. And embrace it. And notice your surroundings, the smells, the sounds. What does it feel like? And just be reminded of the gentle slowness of healing that's probably happening in all of us that's present. All right, let's keep going. So she wakes up, she sees the tomb, it's empty. So she runs back and she tells the dudes. So I've always just found this comical and really haven't mined the meaning. But if you read it, it says, like, so Simon Peter and the other disciple who's happening to write this letter, the one whom Jesus loved, me, said to them, they have taken the Lord out of the tomb. We do not know where they have laid him. Then Peter and the other disciple, who's pretty fast and packs a sprint, set out and went towards the tomb. The two were running together, but the other disciple, who is that, outran Peter and reached the tomb first, right? It's like, I would just read it. I was like, oh, that's like absurd. I don't even know what it means. And I'd just move on, right? And he'd be like, who does Jesus love? This guy. Who packs a sprint? This guy. Who won't be last? Because if you're last, you'll probably get crucified. Who's first? I will always be first. This guy, right? And then I just tried to sit with it a little longer. And I tried to have a little more empathy for John. I was like, oh, they're in full trauma mode. When you experience such loss, all of us, you go to your lizard brain. It's the part of our brain that competes that's probably happening. And I wonder if there's a way to read this that's a little more tender. Maybe he's being vulnerable and he's saying, the one who Jesus loved, like I'm loved, right? They're running to the tomb. He's like, I have value, right? Like I can run. I can at least do something. I got there first. I'm worthy, right? And I propose that these stories are so endlessly meaningful because these are our questions. We wake up each morning. I wake up each morning. And that's the question I'm asking. I'm loved, right? I have value, right? I'm worthy, right? And so for us, maybe we can think through what parts of our lives do we live in scarcity? So there's probably a bit of both in your life. So what relationships do you have that it's kind of you're always worried a little bit. Oh, I better text them back. They got me this for my birthday, Schwick. Like, who are those people in our lives? We probably have them. Then with our work or our vocation or the things we create, what are the things we do out of scarcity? Like, oh, better work harder. Better seem more impressed. Better say better, write smart things. That person got it. Like, what parts of our lives are in that scarcity part? Then how about when it comes to faith in God? What are the parts of our brain where we're like, oh, God's watching. He's like Santa Claus, right? Oh, I did this. I better do some good things. I better memorize. I better fast, right? What parts of our brain do we engage in scarcity with God? And then the flip side is this. What parts of our lives do we live in abundance? Like, who are the relationships? You don't really have to worry if you text them back too soon. It's probably fine. When you're there, there's no posturing. You don't even have to talk. Like, you have those people in your life. It feels a little different, doesn't it? Notice the first and the second. What are the things we make or create or do that isn't out of scarcity? That there's joy there. There's life there. You notice the difference? It probably feels a little different. And when are those times then that you've had, perhaps with God, with the divine, with something bigger than ourselves, where you can just rest and be? Feels different, doesn't it? So this is my version of this story. So you want to hear a secret? Many pastors don't like Easter Sunday. So they won't tell you. They probably aren't allowed to tell you, but we talk amongst ourselves. So this is the thing. You get up, and the clock's ticking, and the story is the exact same every year, and you feel pressure. You have to tell it in a new and meaningful way, and you're just like, oh, right. So this is my 20th Easter homily. Okay, so 2 years ago, It was 10 a.m. on Easter Sunday. Easter, our liturgy starts at 10:30-ish. So remember, I was sitting at home, looking at my final notes, looking on my screen. I had never hated the words of a homily so much. I was looking at my screen. I have never been so disappointed in a homily, but it's 10 o'clock. So I closed the laptop and I'm like, all right, here we go. So if you've been to our old space, that Sunday, the fire code's 175. We had 350 people in there. It was overwhelming for everyone. Like, you couldn't walk. So if you would have taken a picture that morning, so you would have seen all of you, your beautiful faces, everyone's dressed up, and the kids. You would have seen me hiding in the corner with my, in my mind, terrible homily, with my face like. Like, it was too much. It was overwhelming. Okay. So last year, our nav team was like, Gideon, take a break. You take a year off. I was like, really? I'm allowed to do that? So Jason graciously spoke, and he did a wonderful job. And I was there, and I was like, oh, I get it. Easter is awesome when you're not preaching. It's amazing. It's so much fun. I was like, this is fantastic. But that one year just gave me enough space to have some distance from it. And I actually learned something pretty profound. I learned it from my friend Joe Cristofoletti. Is Joe here this morning? I don't think he's here. So you might know Joe's work. He painted a 10-story mural in the convention center parking garage. I have a picture. So that's his work, if you're familiar with it. So he had a show a few months back, and I couldn't make the opening, but I went to the closing. So this was the main piece in the closing, and it was amazing. You can't even tell from the picture, like, the depth and the color of how that pops. It's incredible. So I'm standing there and just like, looking at it, gazing intently. And then his wife Amy comes up, and we start chatting. And then she, somewhere along the conversation, goes, oh, yeah, this is a different piece from the opening. I was like, what? She's like, yeah, Joe made one for the opening, but they had a show in between, so he just painted over it. I was like, what? He made another one, painted over it. He's like, yeah, there's another show. And then for the closing, just whipped up another one. So Joe comes over, and I'm like, what? That's insane. Like, how can you make something so beautiful and then just go, oh, I'm just going to erase it, and you just made it? Like, I think my intensity was like a little, like, he was like, oh, what's going on? And then he just shrugged. He's super gentle and humble. He's like, yeah, Gideon, there's more from where that came from. And maybe the question this morning is, what parts of our lives can we live in that space? That there's more from where that came from. And perhaps the story of Easter is this, with God's love, God's mercy, God's forgiveness, divine love, capital L love, that there's more from where that came from. That a tomb can't hold the force of love. That as high as the heavens are above the earth, as far as the east is from the west, that there's nothing that can separate us from God's love. It's so expansive, so immense. Brennan Manning says it like this. He says, I could more easily contain Niagara Falls in a teacup. So if you've been to the Niagara Falls, just picture that. Then I can comprehend the wild, uncontainable love of God. He says this, the question of the gospel of grace put to us is simply this. Who shall separate you from the love of Christ? What are you afraid of? Are you afraid that your weakness could separate from the love of Christ? It can't. Are you afraid that your inadequacies could separate you from the love of Christ? They can't. Are you afraid that your inner poverty could separate you from the love of Christ? It can't. Difficult marriage, loneliness, anxiety over your children's future, they can't. Negative self-image, it can't. Economic hardship, racial hatred, street crime, they can't. Rejected by loved ones or suffering of loved ones, they can't. Persecution by authorities going to jail, they can't. Nuclear war, it can't. Mistakes, fears, and uncertainties, they can't. Grace calls out, nothing can separate you from the love of God. And so perhaps the spiritual practice here could be this. So don't show the first one yet, Stephen. So I think it's important to define love. We don't have time to fully unpack it. So on one end, maybe you have, I call it brick love. Do you remember Brick from Anchorman? Do you remember that? I love desk. I love lamp. Okay, so that's one end. You got brick love. And then I think sometimes divine love is so big that it's hard to define. Like, it's so lofty. You're like, ah, it sounds nice. What does it mean? So the best definition, the one I like, I prefer the most, is this. Love, or you, agape love, or capital L love, says unmerited, I'm so happy you exist. I think that's the best definition. Unmerited. You haven't done anything. I'm so happy you exist. Okay. So I'm going to invite you into some discomfort. We're going to try it. You can opt out. We're going to do this. You're going to turn to a neighbor. Okay. You can opt out. You don't have to. Put your hand on their shoulder. Look them in the eye. And then just tell them, say it with some enthusiasm. Don't go, oh, I'm sorry. Don't roll your eyes while you're doing that. Just put your hand on the shoulder, look him in the eye, say, I'm so happy you exist. Go. All right. Well done. Good job, everyone. So this is the thing. It's most likely it might not have been genuine. You probably don't know the person you said it to. But it's okay. I wanted you to practice receiving it. I want you to feel what it feels like when someone says those words to you. Okay? And then maybe this week, maybe once a day this week. I think that's doable. Tell someone, hey, I'm so happy you exist. I think it's okay to tell animals and trees and stuff too. All right, let's finish the story. Verse 10, it says the disciples, so the dudes just go home, which probably symbolizes they've just gone back to their old ways. They've given up. They've gone home. And then Mary stood weeping. She had the courage to grieve. She stood in her pain. And then she meets Jesus. She doesn't recognize him. She thinks she's a gardener. They have this interaction. And then verse 16, it says this. Jesus said to her, Mary, calls her by name. She turned and said to him, teacher. And then he says this, don't hold on to me. It's a weird thing, he says. He says, don't hold on to me. And then he sends her. The early church saw Mary as the first apostle, the apostle to the apostles. Because I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers, who are at home sleeping probably, and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, my God and your God. Mary Magdalene went and announced to the dudes, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said these things to her. And so perhaps this morning, that love, capital L love, divine love, is so generous and so secure in its own love, it doesn't imprison us in divine codependency. That God loves us so much, he frees us to live full life and empowers us. So as a parent, this is my journey right now. So I have a son who is on his gap year, is leaving home. And so I'm like, oh, I have some codependency in me. I really prefer him to need me more. And then the less and less that he needs me, I'm like, oh, this feels new and strange, right? And so he was in Melbourne for the first half, and he's in Mexico City now. So would you like to collectively stalk his Instagram? Should we just check out his Instagram story? All right, let's give it a watch. That's not him, by the way. He's just filming. All right, I'll commentate. So he's a photographer, likes taking pictures. Oh, yeah, that's a pretty good one. Yeah, it's nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, got some symmetry, some repetition. Not bad, not bad, right? Oh, he's cooking for himself. Oh, good job, look at him. Then I came to this next video, and I was like, oh, no, he's hanging out by himself on Friday. I need to call him. He needs me. Oh, no, he's so lonely. And in the next picture, no, he's fine. He's having a good time. He doesn't, nope. And he, apparently Frank Ocean is involved in how to recognize a stroke. All right. So don't tell him I showed you. I'm just kidding. I asked. He said I could. So when we dropped him off in Mexico City, this is what I told him. I was like, hey, man, I'm really proud of you. This is yours now. This is your life to live. You make great decisions. You often have. and I trust you. You can trust yourself. It's okay to make mistakes. That's how you learn. Mom and Dad are so proud of you. So we left to Mexico City. I called him the week after, and we were FaceTiming. We dropped him off. First 4 weeks, he's taking Spanish class. He's staying in the dorm. And then we were FaceTiming him the week after, and then it didn't look like the dorm. So we were talking. I didn't want to say anything. I was like, oh, where are you? He's like, oh, my new room. I was like, oh, you have a new room. So it turns out he was in the dorm. There was only one other person, and I guess they were in their 30s and lame. So he met this woman at a seafood restaurant randomly. She was practicing her English. He was practicing her Spanish. Found out she owns a hostel. Made the decision to leave the dorm, move across town to the hostel, and he didn't even ask us. And when he told me that, I was actually so proud. Like, he didn't need to check in. He knew what he needed. He made a decision, and it was a good decision. I was so, so, so proud. And if I, as a selfish, a little bit narcissistic father, can be proud of him and empower him, how much more the limitless love of God that loves us so much, that names us and empowers us to live full and free lives. And so this is my prayer for us this morning, Vox. On this Easter morning, may we be like Mary, named and empowered by love, reminding us unearned, unmerited, in the pure joy of God giving us love, love, that our existence brings happiness to God. Our existence makes him smile. May love slow down our running, interrupt our competing, and quiet the ways we live to earn love. And in our dark nights and gray mornings, may the parts of our lives that are still asleep gently awaken from its slumber to the love of God that rises slow and gently like the morning sun. And may grace echo each day from the empty tomb, whispering to us, there is nothing, nothing that can separate us from the love of God, that we are not separate from God, from ourselves, and from each other. And so I'll close with a benediction. This is from 400 AD, from the Bishop of Cyprus. He's got a sweet name. His name is Saint Epiphanius, killer name. But this is his benediction, and I'll offer it as a benediction this morning. And he says this, I am your God who for your sake have become your son. Out of love for you and your descendants, I now by my authority command all you who are held in bondage, come forth. All who are in darkness, be enlightened. All who are sleeping, arise. I order you, O sleeper, to awake. I did not create you to be held a prisoner in hell. Rise from the dead, for I am life of the dead. Rise up, work of my hands, you who were created in my image. Rise. Let us leave this place, for you are in me, and I am in you. Together we form only one person, and we cannot be separated. And we pray this in the limitless love of God, the risen Christ, and the awakening of the Holy Spirit. Amen.